You seek the key, but first you must learn the ways of precision, craft, and performance with Acura's all-electric ZDX. With a premium Bang & Olufsen sound system, up to a 313-mile range, and a Type S variant with an estimated 500 horsepower, the ZDX is their most powerful SUV yet. Unlock the energy when you visit Acura.com to order yours today. Okay, let's do some quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on multiple systems, on delivering your product or service, the more margin you have and the more money you keep. That's obvious. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. To reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. Here's the thing. Information is power. Information is money. Literally, the currency of today's world of entrepreneurship is information. And if you could bring all of the information about your business into one dashboard, this is incredibly valuable. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, HR into one platform and one source of the truth about your business. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required, access from anywhere. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified business management suite. And you're improving efficiency by bringing all of your major business processes into one platform, slashing manual tasks and errors. This is so valuable. You just hit a button and you can see all the information about your business instead of having to like call five different departments and get all these emails and put it all together and make sense of it. Over 37,000 companies have already made the move. So do the math. See how you'll profit with NetSuite. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/James. netsuite.com/James. netsuite.com/James.
This isn't your average business podcast, and he's not your average host. This is the James Altucher Show on the Stansberry Radio Network.
Big fan of Neil Strauss and his books, The Game and Now The Truth, and his many other books. And also, he's a friend of the podcast. He's been on before. Neil, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you for having me back, despite some of the comments I read after the last ones.
Wait, what were the comments on the last one?
Oh, it was just one guy. One guy was like going wild on Twitter, and I'm sure he's listening now because I was talking about your mom, and he was really upset by that. And I felt, of course, when I read it, that he must have his own issues around that.
What was he upset about?
I think he was upset that I was asking you. It's funny because you're so vulnerable and open on your blog, but I felt he felt it was somehow inappropriate that I was doing something inappropriate asking you about your parents and your upbringing to figure out the keys to who you are.
Oh, well, let's get even more inappropriate then on this podcast.
Great.
So, Neil, we all know what The Game was about. It was about, you know, your experiences following kind of the pickup artist community and then how you kind of got into the scene yourself in a big way. And it reminds me of this kind of genre of literature, like you see it with guys like A.J. Jacobs or where they kind of put themselves into the experience and then write about it. You know, Josh Foer, who wrote about, becoming the U.S. memory champion, or Stephen Fatsis, who becomes a big Scrabble player. You became one of the best guys in the pickup artist community. But now you wrote this book, The Truth, which it's not quite the opposite of what you were saying in The Game, but it's a totally different book. It's totally revealing. I would be scared to death to write a book like that. And it's basically what you are going through as you experience or you try to find the truth about relationships. Do you want to describe, I've read the book several times now. I could describe the whole book from beginning to end, but I don't know how much of a reveal you want to give here. But what do you want to describe what the truth was about?
Sure. I mean, first of all, you could probably do it better because I'm so close to it. And secondly, I'm open to discussing or revealing anything.
I feel like the book is divided into three parts, and it's basically shame is kind of the first part, and exploration is the second part, and kind of satisfaction sort of combined with health is like the third part. And I'm being very broad and general, and we could start to narrow down, but would you say that's kind of true?
Every interpretation, I suppose, is true, and I haven't heard it described that way, but it's a really great analysis of it. I think it's right, though I hadn't thought of it myself like that at all. I think that's great.
Well, I'm curious then why you haven't thought about this. Let's drill down. So shame, I kind of feel, because in the beginning you cheat on your girlfriend, right. And there's kind of a reveal later about her, but you cheat on your girlfriend and you're ashamed about it. So you go to essentially sex rehab and exploring this shame and like why you feel the way you do about cheating and so on. So let me ask you, how's your interpretation different?
It's interesting. I mean, I think my interpretation is I never thought of each chapter as sort of each section as a sort of a, you know, emotional theme versus the storytelling arc. So I think yours is absolutely accurate. I think when I'm trying to think what I think about it as, I don't know. It's, you know, it's the oddest thing. If you ask me to describe any of my other books, I could give you like a little capsule phrase. And this one, I'm so close to it that even after I did a bunch of interviews for it, I still felt every time I wasn't able to represent the book. It's very odd.
Well, it's interesting because you're so close to it because to some extent, I mean, you were living, like basically you, and I'm going to stick to the first section for a little bit. You cheated on Ingrid, your girlfriend at the time. You kind of go into the why, the how, what you felt like. The writing itself is great. Like everything's a cliffhanger, a page turner. I feel like I'm reading a novel while I'm reading it. After you wrote the book, did you feel uncomfortable with all the things you were saying in there?
A few things. I guess every book I've ever written, I've been scared to put it out. And if you're scared before you're putting it out, it's a good thing. So I did feel that fear, and that fear is a sign that you're really saying something meaningful or vulnerable or important. And I think I had paved the way a little bit because I did books with a lot with rock stars and cultural figure books with Motley Crue and Marilyn Manson and all these other autobiographies that I kind of wrote with them. And so we had a bunch of rules for them, and I really held them to those rules, which are A, you have to tell everything. B, you can't be afraid of what anyone else thinks, like your kids or your wife or your mother or your father. You just have to tell the truth. Otherwise you're robbing hundreds of thousands or millions of readers for just one person. And three is you have to say even the things that make you look bad. And if someone wasn't able to do that, I wouldn't do a book with them. And I had to hold myself to those same standards.
I think it's so interesting because so many people decide not to write a book because they can't. I would say 99% of the people who start books can't follow those rules. And that ultimately separates out art from either not doing a book or not doing a good book.
Yeah, exactly. Or one that just sells for like a month because someone's internal fan base buys it and then it just disappears. And I think it's true. And what I learned from those books was that if you share the things you're most afraid to share, you'll resonate with everyone else because they have those secrets and those feelings locked up inside. Or you'll resonate with a certain kind of person who you're speaking for. Great.
So we're all in these relationships where obviously we like look at other women and, you know, some people act on that, some people don't. What do you think, you know, now looking back on it, what do you think in that relationship with Ingrid, you know, initially made you act on it? And you explore this deeply in the first chapter, I mean, the first section, but without any real conclusion to it. There's just a lot of theoretical stuff, not theoretical in a bad way, but like, you have so many different opinions on what could have happened when sometimes people just wander.
Well, I think there's always a reason for what you're doing. And if you don't know the reason, then you're maybe living an unconscious life. So to back up over a couple things we said earlier, one is the reason why that person who emailed, who texted, who Twittered caught my eye was I realized he's not defending you. He's defending his mom, right? He was defending his mom because the reason why it stuck in my head, I was like, oh, I want to talk to this guy. I'm doing this whole podcast just for him to say, hey, listen, if you don't defend a parent because you want to just see the truth. And I'm probably going to go like a step deeper than I want to, both for this guy and both because it addresses what you wanted to talk about, which is that you're living an unconscious life if you don't understand yourself. So part of the goal of the book was to understand my behavior. How could I cheat on somebody I care about and I love or supposedly love and want to have a relationship and want to have a family with. Like you said, sometimes people just stray. But if you think about it, you're violating your ethical, or at least I was. I don't know what everyone else's ethical system is, but you're violating your ethical system, your moral system, you're sabotaging your future, you're hurting, all these things are going in there. So it's not just straying. It's really an active, you're committing an act of trauma against, you know, this psychological health of another human being. You really are. Yeah. So why do people do that is, it's simply this, they're compulsive behaviors, right? If we have a compulsive behavior, a lot of, think about all your books are about choice. When you're not making a choice in your own life, you're under control of compulsivity. It could simply be this, I'm going to stop eating, you know, refined sugar. You can make that choice today, easy to say, or anything else. But if you still eat it after having made the decision not to eat it, then you've been hijacked by something stronger than your decision-making process or your will or what have you. And then maybe you need to explore why that is. So there are many reasons why people cheat. The biggest reasons people cheat is I'll get back to it in a second. Man, this is gonna get kind of deep right away, but
we're going for it. You can't do a podcast without saying something that makes you scared.
That's right. That's right. I think there are many reasons people cheat, but I think the biggest reason why is a fear of intimacy. And it sounds like an overall thing. I mean, if someone said that, I would be like annoyed if, like, you know, Dr. Drew, when someone says that, but I want to explain kind of what I mean by that. And again, so what it means is this, hey, first of all, everybody's free. You're free to do whatever you want. If you're married or you're in a relationship and you meet someone and you want to have sex with them, you're absolutely free to do that. Even if you're in a relationship, you just have to be honest and accept the consequences of it, right?
You're sort of saying that the standards, you should have the same standards in life that you actually have in your writing or that you acquire in your co-authors on books. You're kind of equating the two in a weird way.
Yeah, it's funny. I didn't make that connection, but I think it's absolutely true. And you can tell your partner you're doing that. And if sleeping with that person is more important than your relationship, you know, then go for it. But people start to get this idea that I'm trapped. I'm trapped in my marriage. I'm trapped in my relationship. And it's a story they're telling themselves. It's a psychological story because I think growing up, and this is where the why comes in, for a lot of people, they grew up trapped by someone else's needs. And those needs were usually the parent of the same sex that they're attracted to. So in my case, it would be, here we go back to mom. In my case, it would be mom. And so why I got passionate about that Twitter guy is because I thought, if you're defending a parent, then you don't get the gift of seeing yourself. So when we talk about mom and dad, we're not accusing them of doing anything wrong. Everybody is imperfect, and we're just trying to see ourselves objectively. What factors in our upbringing, what shaped our entire brain and our entire belief system, you know, or at least the architecture of our brain, caused us to make the decisions we make. So there's a pattern, which is this. It's called enmeshment, and it's when a parent uses a child to meet their needs instead of meeting the needs of the child. And this often happens emotionally. If you have a depressed parent, a parent who pulls you in the middle of their divorce and makes you choose sides, a parent who's overbearing, who's full of anxiety, who is a child themselves and you have to take care of, all these reasons cause you to kind of lose your childhood. And as soon as you get trapped in a relationship where someone else's needs overwhelm your own, or you feel their needs as demands, I'll talk about myself. This was 100% true for me. You start looking for an escape. The needier they get, the more you draw away. The more you draw away, they get even needier. You start to look for an escape or a way out or some outlet to release the anxiety and tension, and that often becomes the affair. And it sounds insane, and it took me a while to believe it, but if you start to watch this pattern, you really see it happen. And as an example, when the Ashley Madison hack happened, I looked at an interview with some of the guys who were caught cheating. In the first interview, I think it ran in Vice. The guy said, my biggest fear is that I'll get divorced. And they go, why? And he says, well, I just can't get divorced while my mom is alive. It would break her heart.
Oh, that's so interesting.
Right. So he's still worried about, you know, his mom and his needs over his own.
You know, I've seen in one article where you've said people tend to marry or have relationships with, or at least become close with people who are the opposite of their, let's say, you know, opposite sex parent. But I've also read that people tend to, like, men tend to marry their moms, you know. So which one do you think is more true? Because they're both, I've read both sides.
Yeah, I think it's true that you can marry someone like that parent, or you can marry someone who is the opposite. So you can marry in reaction to that parent. But I think the deeper thing is that we look to marry, and again, I would say probably 60% of the a certain percentage of the audience is really getting insight from this, and some audience is resisting it. And whether you're getting insight or resisting also is going to depend on how you were raised. So I think it's fascinating. But if you look at it, your first experiences with love, your template for love and care is set by those parents. So here's what I think happens. You look for somebody who embodies, and this comes from a guy named Harville Hendricks, who writes a lot about relationships. You look for somebody who embodies the worst traits about your parents, trying to change them and get them to give you what you never got as a child. And it sounds kind of heavy, but often that's what happens. I'll give you an example.
So you had enmeshment. Your mom was very needy and was also somewhat controlling. Like, how did you at least initially, did you see that those worst traits in Ingrid, or like what happened?
Yeah, for sure. Like, I think Ingrid is when we did Strengths Finders, that test where it tells you your strengths, her strengths are like, you know, command. So she's very commanding. She's very assertive. And of course, when I met her, I thought, oh, she's sweet. She's nothing like mom. And then as the relationship goes on, those personality characteristics come on, the command and the, you know, assertiveness and the stubbornness and all these things. And at that point, you have a choice. The choice is to either A, tell your old story and let the relationship dissolve into a power struggle that ends badly. And the old story could be, look, she's trying to control me. She's telling me what to do. I was happy before. I had my freedom. Or the other choice is to say, oh, this isn't coming from a place of fear and anxiety or whatever I had growing up. This is coming from a place of love. That's just who she is. And I need to work on myself and not see it as control, but to see it as a confident person who I wanted to marry.
What if her, like, let's say, commanding side is coming from her own issues, though, of like who her father was, you know, versus you?
It's 100% coming from her own issues. That's why the cover of the book are these puzzle pieces fitting together. If you really do this, if you want to do an interesting dialogue or figure out stuff out with your partner, see how similar your mom was to their mom or your dad was to their dad. You'll find things are either almost very much the same or exactly complementary. So for sure, growing up, you know, it generally tends to be the pattern that someone who is enmeshed, as we said, by the sex of parent they're attracted to will connect with somebody who was abandoned by the sex of parent they're attracted to. So one person's automatically going to be needier in the relationship. The other person's going to be more avoidant in the relationship. So anyway, in her case specifically, she was always the rescuer in her family. She had a rescue mom. If she didn't rescue mom from the bad men mom was dating, you know, the bad abandoning men mom was dating, no one would be safe. So she gets into kind of hero mode, right? And she'll want to save the day by taking charge. And that will trigger my own issues of control. And I hope that everyone who's here in a relationship recognizes how this can happen. And that this, what I was going to say earlier was the biggest epiphany I got from the book. I want to talk about how to get past this, but the biggest epiphany I got from the book is this. Your relationship has nothing to do with the other person. The success of your relationship has really nothing to do with the other person. It all has to do with how you relate to the other person. It has to do with you.
Let me ask about that, because let's say you're with somebody and I don't know, and you decide you don't want to be with somebody who's going to cheat on you, and they cheat on you. So that's something that was outside of your kind of, let's say, sphere of influence there. You know, now it has nothing to do with you. It could be her own issues or his own issues, you know, depending on who you are. What are you supposed to do? You don't say it's my own problem. She's the one he's the one who cheated. You might leave the relationship because it's not for you.
Exactly. So there are two things. One is, yeah, your choice is how you relate to him. So if you're, I know people who cheat, a lot of people say I would leave that person as soon as they cheated. But often when that rupture happens, they stay in the relationship and distrust them the whole time. So it's still how you relate to them. You find out they cheated and you can either have the self-esteem to walk away, or B, if they show not a willingness to change, but they actually go and do the work and are willing to earn back trust. If you choose to, you can stay, but those are all your choices you're making. And secondly is you also chose that person. So what part of you chose that person, you know, and look for that in the next relationship. If somebody says all men cheat or all women cheat, I always think, well, you've chosen the men or women who cheat, or you chose to see men or women that way, and what part is your responsibility?
And so it's all, you know, one thing I really appreciate in the book is that I get this overwhelming sense that you want to get to a point where you're not judging anybody and you're not being judged. And you're trying right. to find throughout this, you try. So we're going to get into the sort of might be considered the more meatier section in a second. But I sort of feel like throughout all of this, you're just trying to find out what you like and how you can express what you like in a way where you're not going to be judged and you're not going to judge the people around you. And that, you know, sort of makes for a good relationship if you're both happy in that context.
It is amazing. Like, so much of the time when I hear somebody complaining about their partner and I got to drill in, like I'll really find that their story is just not the truth and it's mostly about the way they see him. And so to close the question from before, so what do you do? Obviously, you said her behavior is coming from her own stuff, is that on the other – so there's an overall pattern that relationships go through, right? And the first stage is projection. You're projecting whatever will fill the empty space in your heart on this person. They're the one, they're this, they're that. And you see them through this mist that has nothing to do with them, but just with your own sort of needs. And then gradually it comes to a point where, there's always that 3 month or 6 month window where, you know, when someone can't have a relationship longer than 6 months, you realize they've never actually been in a relationship where you start to see the real person. And that's when people get upset. They say they tricked me, or I was disillusioned, they say. And to quote Joseph Campbell, he says there's nothing better than being disillusioned, because now your illusions are gone. You're seeing the real person. So at that point, you actually get to see the real person. Those issues start to come out. Those all the childhood fears come out. All the imperfections start to come out. And then a phase that they call the power struggle occurs. And then on the other side of that are several choices. And either A, there's a marriage or a relationship where we're always fighting and arguing and intensity, or B, there's one where you're living two separate lives in under one roof. Three, you separate, or four, you work through it. And the way that Ingrid and I work through it through all the work in the book and consultants of all these experts is that we recognize what's ours in the relationship. So I think, hey, like she knows when she's taking over in hero mode that it's about her issues and not about me, and I know it's about my issues, not about her.
You kind of just gave the reveal, which is that you cheated on Ingrid. Then you go through all this sex rehab. Then you explore all the alternatives. And when I say explore all the alternatives, it's everything from like orgies to sex parties to the house where you're all living together and trying to have kind of almost this commune like sex house. And then finally, the reveal of the book is you get back together with Ingrid, you're married, and you have a kid.
Right. And by the way, I always thought I knew, like, anyone could look me up and see that I was married. So I always thought of it, the book, like Double Indemnity, where you know the answer at the end, but you want to know how did that get there and how did it happen and what can I learn about myself along the way.
And you know, one of the things you learned is that love is the process that needs to be learned somehow. It's like all these things you're saying about parents, these are things you're not taught at the age of 18. You're kind of like thrust out into the world of adult relationships, and no one ever taught you or the individual how to learn how to love or be in relationships. All these things you discovered in part through mistakes, or as you say, being disillusioned at different points. So
it's amazing. Yeah, it's amazing. And like, I think, and I only realized this after writing the book, is that like there's a problem in our culture where, you know, if we're sick, we go to a hospital for our physical health. For our intellectual health, we have to go to school. But we're not taught about our emotional health, and there's nothing. And the only reason we get any instruction on emotional health is if we really sort of are really behaviorally sick in some way. And I think that culture needs some apparatus for teaching people about emotional health, because I hear even people thinking they're talking about positive stuff, talking about really emotionally unhealthy things, that things that sound good in our culture.
You made the first attempt, again, in this first section, where you tried to go to sex rehab and you were exposed to, let's say, a couple different philosophies of rehab. And that means, I mean, like my feeling is when I see, oh, celebrity just checked in for sex addiction rehabilitation, I think that sounds like BS.
Right. It's funny when people say that, oh, that's just an excuse to win back the public or to win back your wife or your partner or something. And I'm sure some people go into rehab for that reason, but I think for most of the people there, they're really trying to find out, you know, what's wrong with them. I love, I'll tell you why I love addiction therapy and I love rehab, even if I don't necessarily believe in addiction, in say sex addiction as it's defined by most of the people who define it. Why I love it is this: because lives are at stake. So for most people who get therapy, you go in an office and you talk with someone who's way overpriced for like an hour, and then you leave with a couple pieces of advice or a couple thoughts, or maybe they just listen to you. And then there's no treatment plan. It goes on forever. But in rehab, it's like, okay, if there's not a change, you may die, right? You may, shoot up too much. You may, an esophageal vein may burst from alcohol. You may actually die. So, or you may get a fatal disease of some sort. So lives are at stake. And so they just have to use what works. And I think the therapy model they use there could be more widespread across to everybody in the good therapies where they really deal with good rehabs, where they really deal with what we're calling your core issues, your family, core family issues.
And so that's where you started to kind of, I mean, that's where you started talking about enmeshment and so on in the book.
Yeah. And so the answer to your question is, when I checked in at various points, they said that sex addiction was, if you watch porn, if you masturbate, and I think there's some groups that, like Sexaholics Anonymous, where if you have premarital sex, that's all sex addiction. I probably just made almost every one of your listeners a sex addict. So it's so insane. So I think like the bludgeon of sex addiction is often used to advance a sex negative stance, on society. So that's where it's detrimental, more so than people just claiming it. But that said, there are obviously people with sexually compulsive behaviors that hurt their lives and the lives of people around them, and in other cases are just straight up abusive and illegal and everything. So I think if you have any behavior you can't control, especially if it's one that's harmful to you and the lives of others, look into it, whether you call it an addiction or not.
You reached this interesting position in the book where it felt like you were getting some nuggets from the sex rehab, but you weren't quite like an addict, let's say, like many people might be. So eventually you check yourself out. But what would you say is the one thing you gained the most from the experience in this part of the book?
The awareness. And it's fascinating. So I gained the awareness of all the patterns that play out in my life that cause me to be dysfunctional in relationships. So I gained the awareness, but the amazing thing was that the awareness was not enough. And that's kind of where that second section begins. And by the way, I was thinking about your intro at the beginning of the show, and I'm not sure about those books. I know for some of them, some of the books are book ideas. Someone comes up with a book idea and a proposal, they sell the proposal, they go do the book. In my case, for my books, I'm just living my life and have a problem that I try to fix. And at some point along the way, I'm in the midst of it. And then I think, you know what, I need to write a book about this because I'm sure other people have this problem. Maybe I can solve it.
So the game, you were fascinated by this community, but then you became so fascinated you wanted to become a part of it and even like dominate it. And in this one, The Truth, it's more memoirish in the sense that this is like you're telling an interesting story that a lot of people can relate to. And it happens to be a very compelling story about sex and relationships and your own experience, your own very intense experiences with it. Part of the thing I was wondering when I was reading the book was, this sounds almost like, did you throw yourself into all this drama so you could write a book?
Oh yeah. I wish I could say yes.
Cause let's go into the second section. What I define as the second section, you go all out. Like, I think honestly, I'm just going to be real honest. I think if I was like at a sex party, I would not function because I would just be like totally nervous about everything happening around me. And I think you sort of eased into it that way as well. Like you were just, it was like, it seemed scary to you at first, but then you like full force got into it.
Exactly. No, I relate to that neuroticness. I mean, here's the irony was, I after I went through all this and I really tried for a year to do all the sex addiction stuff and stay in the program and all that other stuff that they want you to do. I was just like, you know what? Monogamy isn't natural. It makes no sense. I felt like I was it just felt unnatural. I was unhappy. I was miserable. I'm just like, why am I going along with this? Like there's nothing in science. There's nothing in biology. There's nothing that says that human beings are supposed to be monogamous. And so I thought maybe, and this is when I decided to write a book, it was going to be a very different book. I thought, you know what? Maybe I need to find the type of relationship that works for me, that's true to who I am as a human being. Why am I accepting this trope that the Catholic Church in the 9th century decided was going to be the way things are and started enforcing. Why are we still living under the shadow of that?
Well, was it the Catholic Church of the 9th century? Because, I mean, like, monogamous relationships have been in many different cultures for thousands of years.
Yes, and I think if we look at where it came into in our culture and what was happening before then, that was the influence in our culture that really started making it a doctrine and not allowing divorce and all those sorts of all those sorts of tropes. I think if you trace in our particular culture where it came back from, it would be that. But I'm sure there are other narratives and arguments.
So okay, so now you start exploring and nothing really was like, it all sounded like fantasy world. Like every guy could like, or maybe every woman too can say, oh my gosh, this is like sexual fan, like Disneyland. But at the same time, you were very quickly getting unhappy with each alternative you were trying. Like very quickly you were getting unhappy.
Yeah. I got into the polyamory world. I tried to live with several girlfriends. Like you said, I tried to put together sort of, everything was sort of, okay, if I can just and exactly, so nothing worked, and but that said, the reason nothing worked was not because those lifestyles don't work. They work great. There are plenty of happy people in polyamorous relationships and open relationships and every type and variation relationship you can think of, and there are plenty of unhappy, miserable people, and they're just like the same. And the same goes in monogamy too. And eventually I realized that the common denominator between all these relationships was me. And the problem wasn't that relationships were broken. It's that I was broken. Because it's easy to blame society. It's much harder to blame yourself.
Right. That's interesting. So what do you think made you unhappy then? Okay, put it this way though. We all grow up thinking that monogamous relationships are the way we're supposed to go. So doesn't that make it extra harder to have like an open relationship or polyamorous relationship?
I think that's absolutely true. And there's something called the burning period where you change your relationship style or you open up your relationship. There's a period of even as much as 2 years that it takes to sort of deal with all the emotions and complications that brings up. And you're absolutely right. There are no models for it in the culture, no healthy models for it. There's no, we're just not taught that. So you're absolutely right. And it definitely takes a transition period. Yet, I mean, I think like anything, if you switch to a new career, you're going to have to learn a new skill set. It's going to be tough for a few years as well.
So I'm not being critical here, but do you feel like you gave yourself a chance to put in the 2-year burning period on these different types of relationships?
The answer is they already reached such a depth of dysfunction that they wouldn't have survived that period. So I think again,
like instantly, like when you had like everybody living in the house, that was like instant. That was like 3 days.
Yeah, pretty much. Yeah. And I thought this would be great. I mean, I'm going to choose 3 people who I've had, non-monogamous experiences with already and we'll love together in a house and we'll talk about this and it'll really be about, sexual freedom and exploring and fun and connection and freedom. And within like a few days, and I really thought that in my head, yet in retrospect, having talked about enmeshment, if I feel trapped by the needs of one person, I'm going to feel 3 times as trapped by the needs of 3 people. And if you can't handle a relationship with one person, then don't try to do it with 2 or 3 or 4.
One other thing I was curious about was, I mean, there was like basically 3 women. What if they had outside relationships? Were you okay with that?
Oh, yeah, of course. Yeah, I was okay with that. In fact, I think one of them may have. I think one of them did. Yeah, one of them had someone. Yeah, I was okay with that, of course. It wasn't like going to be some kind of like, patriarchal, backward thing. Of course, everybody was free to do what they wanted.
But now that you're in a monogamous marriage with kid, if Ingrid were to suddenly start having sex with somebody else, it would probably upset you.
But it's funny. I'm actually not – here's the conclusion I came to and that Ingrid's feels too is that the whole idea of monogamy and non-monogamy is just a stupid dichotomy. Like there's no truth to monogamy or non-monogamy. It's just a cultural concept. And the marriage that we kind of chose to have. And first of all, when I got back together with her, I just wanted to be with her. I had no desire to be with anybody else. And over time we really discussed this stuff. And especially after she read the book and And what we said is that whatever our marriage is, we're going to do whatever is true to the three entities that are in our relationship, which is me, her, and the relationship itself. So if it's healthy for those three things, then we'll do them. We don't have to define itself by anything. So for example, if I'm on a book tour and I meet somebody and I want to sleep with them, is that healthy for her, the relationship? Not really. So that doesn't need to be done, but maybe there are other things or adventures, or maybe there's a later point when it is. So we're going to be true to ourselves, not to some vague cultural concept. So it's funny because all the press was really, I want to say the press was very sex negative about the book, because it was all like, you know, whatever, game author embraces monogamy, monogamous marriage or something. And I thought it's very, it's not like promiscuity is bad. It's not like monogamy is bad. It's not like non-monogamy is bad. It's why you're doing stuff that makes it bad. It's not, or it makes it unhealthy. It's not what you're doing.
So, okay. So how do we all kind of work internally on sort of building that health so that we can handle, let's say either, you know, or basically handle the type of relationship that you're handling right now?
Great. Yeah. So I would say the answer is, and by the way, the other key to the relationship is total, really honesty. Like I really am, I let her know everything. There's no part of my life or my desire, sexual life, everything that's compartmentalized or kind of protected from her.
Like, let's say you were just attracted to some woman walking down the street. You wouldn't necessarily tell Ingrid every single woman you were attracted to, you know, that you looked at.
I mean, I would only tell her, first of all, she did her own work to get past her own fear. So a lot of times when someone's like worried about someone watching porn or being attracted to other women, what they're really worried about is being abandoned, right? There's nothing wrong like with having desire for another human being. There's nothing wrong with that. But some people in relationships have so much fear about that because it's about their own abandonment issues. They're worried that they're not worthy enough, or they'll lose that person. And through control, they feel like they can get safety. So Ingrid did her own work as well. Like, and without me even requesting or saying anything, when I got back, she saw how much I had changed through all the work I'd done after this whole period we talked about. And she started like getting interested, and she started working on her own stuff. And then I think together we met at that place where she had less fear of abandonment. I had less fear of being smothered or trapped. And then together we could kind of build something new. So tell me the question again. I got off on a tangent.
So yeah, because I distracted you with radical honesty, but you were going to say about how do we build up this internal health, or how do we at least – I don't think anybody can be totally healthy. I think it's a daily sort of practice, but how do we – what is that practice?
There's a phrase I use. You have to become a scientist of your own lows. So you have to take the journey, your own journey. And that journey is to really discover, you know, yourself. And to find the person you were kind of born to be or supposed to be, and find the part of yourself that's creative, that creates in life. You know, people talk about the authentic and false self, but they're so hard to determine. So I prefer the terms the creative self that brings forth and creates, and the destructive self, the part that overreacts to things, the part that hurts relationships, the parts that hurts yourself. And so by looking at the points where your response is inappropriate to the situation, or where you can start to find, let's say, the unhealthy psychological cancers that you can start to zap.
I like this notion of overreact, because it also feels like a very, I'm going to call it secular Buddhist notion, the idea of noticing yourself reacting perhaps irrationally to something in the world, and just simply noticing it is kind of the key to dealing with it.
Yeah, and I think the first step is to notice. And by the way, an overreaction doesn't have to be getting angry or losing your temper. It can also be shutting down. It can be being, you know, snide and critical. There are places we overreact, and what it is it's you react as if it's or fear. You know, I'm sure a lot of people have a fear of fears that aren't valid. Fears of around money and other things. So where do we go into survival mode when we're actually going to survive and our life isn't in danger? And it's probably because back when we were a child, it was survival mode, but now it's not, because we're adults who can take care of ourselves and we're going to be okay. You know, as long as we're not killed, you know, we're going to be okay, or almost whatever happens. So, so looking at those things, you can start to almost run a virus scan. That maybe that's it. It's running a virus scan on yourself and finding the bugs in your operating system.
That's really interesting, because the reality is we like, you know, assuming no major bad things happen, we are probably going to be okay and live long lives. Like there's an average lifespan of, you know, if you're already like in your 40s, your average lifespan could be in your 80s now. So you're going to be okay in the long run, at least in terms of living on this planet. But, you know, we kind of bog ourselves down with so many stresses, like, is she doing this? Am I losing money on this? Am I worried about this? Or why are they treating me like this? And all of these things are so unimportant. And I guess that's a little what you mean by health. But again, how can we start to deal with that better and better?
So here's what you do. Number one is like what we were just talking about. So the first step is self-awareness, really becoming aware of the things that drive you. And like you said earlier, sometimes people just cheat. Sometimes if you accept that way of thinking, then you need to know the why. You need to know the why of why you do the things you do and why who you are and why you are that way. Really understanding the root causes. So the first thing is to become aware of them.
Okay, but that's a challenge because most people don't look the layers deep. You know, they don't have the ability or they don't want to.
Yeah, I mean, it's true. And the reason they don't want to is because we built defenses against the pain inside, right? And they don't want to because of that pain, especially people who are sort of, you know, grandiose or feel like they're better than others. Or this writer, James Hollis, who I love and just spoke to this group I run, said narcissism is the reflection of a, you know, of someone who's of an empty inside. He said it much more eloquently than I did. But we have to recognize the walls we put up to protect ourselves. Irving Yalom was a writer, described stuff as, imagine a city that's built a wall around itself to protect itself from foreign invaders, and years later, hundreds of years later, the invaders go away and the wall's still up, even though the invaders are gone. So we have to break down those walls, and it's scary because we've been trained by these habits of 10, 20, 30, 40, 50 years to think they're still out there. So we're going to have a lot of fear.
A lot of times you don't even realize that they're there. Like, I just want to tell you a recent experience. So I had something relatively traumatic happen to me recently, and I realized in the past 2 months that just looking back on it, I wasn't aware of it at the time, but I canceled every single trip, like business trip or vacation trip outside of New York. And I always had a good reason of canceling them, but there was such a significant pattern. I'm like, why? Finally, I'm realizing, why am I canceling every single either business trip or conference or vacation or whatever outside of the city? And I didn't even realize I was doing something kind of a little bit more internal until someone pointed out to me, like, look, you just had this huge stress, and traveling itself is a stress. And so you're probably constantly trying to find reasons to avoid that stress. And you're smart enough to keep finding like good reasons when they're actually the real reason might be this initial stress you had.
And you needed your friend. And that, I think that's the big,
I needed my friend. You're exactly right. Like I couldn't have seen that on my own because I had good reasons. I was telling myself I had all these good reasons.
The smarter you are, the easier it is to fool yourself.
and I fool myself all the time. So I'm,
you're really smart. Yeah. But I guess we want to get to the place of wisdom, where, right? Beyond intelligence to wisdom. So the key is this. I mean, I think it's tough, and that's why this book's kind of tough to talk about. And maybe this even, I don't know how this conversation's kind of landing with people, but I think that the game was about behaviors. It was really easy to be like, oh, if I turn my body a little this way and don't approach somebody, you know, head on, like they're going to have a better reaction. And if I say these words, they'll be easier. And behaviors are easy to change. This book, maybe if you want to sum it up, it's about beliefs. And it's so hard to recognize your beliefs, let alone change them, because you're living with yourself. Like trying to see yourself is like trying to touch your left elbow with your left hand. Everyone else can do it, but you.
Well, you know, it's funny because in the game, you're trying to basically create these artificial conditions where you feel like you're in control of a social situation. Whereas in the truth, you kind of had to give up control in order to finally find, you know, essentially the marriage that you're in right now.
Yeah, you nailed it. You nailed it because in childhood, of course, I couldn't let myself be vulnerable or defenseless because I would be, hurt or extinguished or what, you know. And so,
other than the enmeshment with your mother, and you discuss that in the book, do you think there are other reasons you felt that way? Like, did you think you were unworthy in some way of women? So kind of cheating or, you know, using pickup techniques or whatever.
Oh, for sure. For sure. For sure. Yeah. I think for sure there are plenty of other reasons. Another reason is validation, right? Like I find that a lot of guys who read the game and are attracted to that, had a critical parent who was made a bit well-meaning, but it's always like, you just got a B, that should have been an A, or, you know, you're not good enough at that, or your brother or sister are better at that. And the parent was using criticism to try to motivate them to greatness. And all the parent did was crush and destroy their self-esteem. And then you walk around feeling like not enough. And you said shame, and shame's the key word. Anytime you're out there and you feel less than somebody else, because all human beings are of equal worth and value. Whenever you feel less than somebody, like someone's better than you, your shame's just been triggered. So that's one key to identifying that stuff. And so you walk around a constant shame, and, you know, meeting someone and having them like you, then we don't have to. It doesn't have to be about sex. Having them just like you. Some people who flirt, right, for positive attention, is like a shot of heroin to that sense of shame. The validation is the drug.
So what made you finally say, okay, I can't handle all this stuff anymore. I'm going to go back to Ingrid and see what that's like.
It was the producer Rick Rubin who's in the book, and I write for Rolling Stone, and so,
and he was very non-judgmental of you in this weird way throughout the whole book. Like he was like this cool guy who was always pointing things out to you, but hey, you were still like surfing together and stuff. It wasn't like, oh, I can't be friends with Neil anymore.
No, he was like a true friend. Like, and I think you'd need someone in your life, and if you don't have it, I can talk about that, but you need someone in your life who can reflect yourself back to you so you can see yourself a little bit. And he said, look, you got everything you want in the game. I remember when he read the game when it first came out, he said, I don't think it's done. And I was like, oh, you're just a perfectionist. It's done. And he said, you got everything you wanted. Why are you still not happy? And so that maybe was the conversation, or it was actually probably 100 conversations before I realized he was right. I was like, what are you talking about? I'm happy. You know, before I realized he was right. And that really was what set off the journey in addition to my guilt over what I'd done.
What happened then? So Rick is talking to you and you're not happy, but you're going through, you're happy. Well, first off, what was the most amazingly pleasurable experience during this exploration period, so people could kind of judge what you were giving up when you kind of went back to, let's call it, quasi-monogamy?
No, good question, because we're talking about it. This is heavy, heavy stuff. I would probably say it was when I was, this sounds so quote unquote heteronormative, sort of like very sort of like normal heterosexual culture fantasy. So I think it was when I was dating somebody who, and she also liked women. So we would bring lots of female partners home. And so they're definitely like, literally, probably when I wrote those books on Motley Crue and Marilyn Manson and Jenna James and all these books, looking for those to be around people who had these larger than life sexual experiences. I was finally having ones even maybe they hadn't had. So that was definitely the most like decadent period.
And were your friends like jealous of you?
Either a little jealous or a little living vicariously. But
you must have been so busy, you probably didn't have time to like get back to your quote unquote normal life. Like it's pretty busy to do the exploration you were doing.
Yeah, no, I remember like the other or they would try to like kind of hang out to like, I remember they like show up at my house at like weird hours just to see if like there was something going on that maybe there was like somebody going spare or something. It was really like very, very like, yeah, I mean, I don't know. It's funny. There's something called euphoric recall where you imagine the imagined experiences in the past is great. But I'll tell you, the challenge of being with multiple people is not actually people think, oh, how do you, what's the choreography of it? It's actually the mental choreography, because we're with a bunch of different people. Someone's, worried about something. Someone else is uncomfortable with this. Someone else is, oh, they have a partner, they're cheating on someone, or someone else, maybe they're, it's a woman with her girlfriend, or girlfriend's not into a guy being there. Like, so you're actually dealing with the mental choreography, not the physical as much, especially if you're like me or like you, who are in semi-neurotic.
Yeah. I honestly don't think I would like it very much. Cause I think, obviously there seems like great aspects of it, but I think I would just be constantly jealous or insecure, to be honest.
But I will say, maybe you just have to go through the burning period enough to do it. But I will say there were definitely, like, if I think about it, there were definitely like some sexual moments that were like, you know, probably like the high of a heroin addict's greatest rush that I'll never forget as far as peak kind of pleasure fantasy experiences.
And so, okay, so coming down from this,
they're in the book. So I feel like talking about them seems.
No, they're definitely in the book, and I'm gonna keep recommending the book. But I want to get now into, so you get back together with Ingrid, and you know, even more so in terms of writing. So let's just skip ahead. You get back together with Ingrid, and you're married, you have a kid. Obviously, you've made huge changes and decisions, and then you write this book, and she reads it. That must have been a scary moment for you when she's reading the book.
Yeah, for sure. I think that definitely the moment when Ingrid read the book, and it's got everything. And the scary part wasn't the experiences I was just talking about, because those things happened where apart. The scary part was me talking about my inner monologue sometimes when I'm with her and I'm resenting this and annoyed by this. You know, that was the scariest part. And she read most of it, just the worst parts really. And as she said, she read it more like a journal or a diary than like a book. And she was upset for a couple of days, and we kind of talked through everything so she could really understand it. And since then, it's been the best thing that's ever happened to us, because as I said earlier, there are really no secrets. She really knows me. And I think giving the partner the gift of really knowing you and then being able to make a choice, because that's what we do when we cheat. We say we do what we want to do, but they don't get a choice. You know, they don't get a choice of whether they want to accept us or not, knowing who we are and what we've done. So, and her knowing all that and making the choice and knowing who I am and knowing there's nothing hidden. A lot of the fears and insecurities in the relationship came from her not knowing stuff. Really just we're great. It really brought the relationship to a new place. So I recommend everybody do it.
It was kind of resolving the uncertainty plus saying, hey, I'm here. I'm like going to tell you all this, but I'm also here. So then she could kind of trust that you're there.
Yep. That's a great way to put it. And the truth is, if you show yourself to somebody, right? If you show yourself to somebody and they choose no, they're doing you a favor. That means that person's not right for you. Do you really want to go through your life? You know, I talk to people and they talk about gaming their wives or their husbands or their books like kind of Why Men Love Bitches that are about, or, you know, even the game to a certain degree, but about emotionally withholding a relationship so your husband doesn't think you're too needy. My thought is, like, if you're not showing up as yourself in your relationship, you're not in a relationship.
Yeah. So, once she read the book, did she ever feel like, oh my gosh, Neil has this great outlet. He can be creative. He can write a book and talk about all this stuff. But now I'm going through all these things. Like, what's her creative outlet to kind of do psychic surgery on herself?
Yeah. Well, it's interesting. I went through some really cool processes, and I wanted to come back to that because we never really talked about the ways to kind of get over stuff. And she went through some of the processes that I went through in the book, and they're available to anybody. But I found that what really works to change is she went through that stuff herself, and she's super creative anyway, so she didn't feel like it. It's actually cool that we get to speak the same language and recognize the same things. And by the way, it's not required. If she didn't do any of this stuff, I would be totally fine and accept her as obviously as she is. That's why you're with somebody. So your partner doing the work isn't a requirement. Being able to communicate is a requirement, but they don't have to do the work. They don't have to do anything.
You know, you say one of the most important lessons you learned through this whole process is that you can't make anyone happy.
Yes.
And, you know, I think that's really interesting. Like, you know, too often we do want, and for you, all of the issues are about control and, you know, wanting to please and feeling shame when you didn't, and then getting out of that completely to do the exploration. It seems like the biggest thing you learned about yourself is that I'm not going to try to change anybody else. And that's going to be the key to a relationship that I'm in.
It's so true. I think there's kind of two parts to what you said. One is obviously you don't have to do anything, but if you're going to be with someone, accept them as they are. And if they choose to change of their own accord, that's just a bonus. But a lot of people are in relationships thinking, oh, if only someone could do this or be like that, then it'll be great. And all you're doing is you're setting up a toxic pattern for you to just resent them for not changing and poisoning the relationship. So you have to be willing to accept someone as they are to have a relationship with them, as not as you wish they would be.
But what if you really like 8 out of 10 features of someone, you just, and you love them, you love those 8 features, but you don't like the final 2, And you're afraid that you're not going to meet somebody who is going to like you again, you know, because you're insecure.
You will accept 8 things out of 10. Like, and here's the deal. There's something Rick Rubin said about collaboration when artists are collaborating. If he says, if you're collaborating as artists and you all agree on everything, then the other people are redundant, are irrelevant. You don't need them because you all agree. So there, hopefully 8 out of 10 sounds great. And then it is your work to learn to accept the 2 things out of 10 that allow them to be in a unique individual who's different than you. You know, 8 out of 10 sounds awesome.
Yeah, I kind of like that.
And then what was the second part of your question?
You're afraid that if things don't work out, like let's say the 2 things are actually intolerable to you. Like for instance, they want to cheat on you or whatever, and you don't like that. But you're afraid that you're just not going to meet someone who's got these 8 things that you really love.
Yeah, got it. So yeah, and I think that does happen. People stay in relationships because they're afraid they can't meet someone else again. First of all, I would look at the things that are intolerable to you, because if they're like, even being, if you're afraid that they're going to cheat on you, it may be your own story that comes from your own abandonment, or because mom cheated on dad, or dad cheated on mom. So the first thing is the things that are supposedly intolerable to you. I would really look at those things and see what of yourself you're projecting onto those things. So I would first explore that. Secondly, if they are intolerable, such as somebody is emotionally or physically abusive, right? And cheating is emotional abuse, I would say. It's just funny. I think that fear keeps people in relationships that I won't find someone again. And that comes from a core belief that you're not lovable. So if you think about the 2 things you said, and I'm just thinking out loud right now, the 2 things you said are nothing about the other person. They're about your own belief that you're not lovable. Again, you might have been just projecting about someone else, but maybe not. Because A, I'm afraid that she'll cheat on me means there's someone better out here for her than me. B, I won't meet anyone means no one else will love me. So they'll come. So those things are actually all about you and the belief I'm not lovable. So I'd work on that, because guess what? Any relationship you get in with the belief I'm not lovable will probably become a self-fulfilling prophecy.
You know, it's interesting, because this is related to the idea. I think I heard you mention this on another podcast, where relationships aren't about, like, you know, we're kind of like in this success or failure binary society. And so you either like are married forever or it's a quote unquote success, or you're divorced and you somehow failed. And you mentioned that relationships are more like something to learn from rather than say that was a success or that's a failure. You know, do you, and I feel that's what the truth was all about, like kind of what you learned at each step of the way and all these different relationships you had.
I think that's so true. I really think that people say if a relationship ended, they think it's a failure. I think the failed relationships are the ones that last longer than it should. When I talk to somebody, when I look at my parents' relationship, they've been unhappily together for, you know, something like 50 years.
So like afraid to fail.
Yeah. But the failure is staying in an unhealthy relationship that's not good for your spirit.
Right. So you have to kind of redefine your definition of failure. And that applies to every area of life, like book writing, business, relationships, and so on. That failure, quote unquote, society's definition of failure might just could be mean, what can I do better from here?
Yeah, it's funny. You know, I watch, and I agree with what you're saying, because I think yourself, me, everyone else who's been successful in life realize, you know, says there's no such thing as failure. There's only learning lessons. But I learned something from my son, who's now 9 months, which is when he's learning to walk or he's learning to sit up. He's always practicing, like all day long. He'll practice. First was trying to roll over, then it was standing, now walking. He's always practicing. And when he's practicing, he can just do it all day. The very few times when he tries, he gets frustrated and annoyed. So I just think, how can I be in the state of practice versus the state of trying?
I love that. I think that's how can I be in a state of practice versus a state of trying is like such an important notion. You know, this begs the question, really. You wrote this book. It's so intense about relationships and everything we go through in relationships, which are really kind of the most important things in our life. What are you going to do next? You're going to have to like totally turn into a drug addict or something. Like, what's going to happen to Neil?
Yeah. No, it's funny. You know what? I think that maybe the cycle of, you know, books that are about problems in my life that I try to solve may be at an end. And there's some other books that I have under contract that I want to write. I really want to write a book. I want to write a book. I think this is going to be the next book. It's really going to be about communication, because I think people do it really badly and don't get heard. And I think people listen really poorly and don't actually hear what other people are saying, and they make up a bunch of stuff that they assume is that way and respond accordingly. And then this leads to a lot of everything from murders to divorces to you know, pain, suffering, misery, and disconnection. So I think I'd love to write something about communication that maybe is an addendum of sorts to this book, but you know, not necessarily related to it. That's just about rethinking how we speak and listen.
One final question. You know, I heard somewhere you say that you have to remove the phrase "what if" from your vocabulary, and I didn't quite understand what that meant.
Simple example is, so many people I talk to about relationships may say, "Well, I'm happy now, but what if?" And everyone has their one. What if? What if she cheats on me? What if I cheat on her or him? What if? What if I grow bored? What if they grow bored? They project so many what ifs, and a what if is what? A what if is a fear of the future. And all the people, and by the way, myself included, I was the master of ambivalence. I would always be like, what if I get bored? What if I want to sleep with someone else? What if, you know, what if I end up as unhappy as my mom and dad did? All those things. And I realized that whatever I was what ifing, my worries about the future kept me from being like appreciating the love I had in the present. And so by changing what if to I will accept it if she cheats on me. I will accept it if I cheat on her. I will accept it if she grows bored of me. I will accept it if I grow bored of her. Allow me to let go of that.
So what if is about the future, but why is about the past? So if something happens that, let's say your partner does, to not ask why, because you're never going to get an answer. Like if she does something, let's say she cheats and you didn't like that, you can't really ask why, and because you can't change the past. You could just say something like, I wish this hadn't happened, but...
I wish still sounds like a hope. I wish sounds even more like a hope to change it. I guess you have to say, I'll accept it too. And I guess you can say why about yourself. You can't say why about someone else. Like I think you're saying, you can say why about yourself. Why did I, what drew me to that person? Is there, what responsibility might I have? How can I, why did I, when it was going under my nose, was I blind to it? Because a lot of times people know it's happening, but they're, or know that it's there, but they sort of stay in fantasy. So you can say the why about yourself, but I think you're right. Saying the why about the other person, there's a phrase called pain chopping. You know, people pain chop trying to get all the details, feeling like they'll never know enough and pain chopping. But I think that's true. I think maybe even saying, you know, I accept that they did that, and now I got to go on my own journey to explore why this happened so it doesn't happen again.
So Neil, the truth, oddly, is this weird sort of book where it's about your life completely, and it's about this truth and authenticity that you always bring to the page, which is really magnificent, and so many writers are afraid to do it. And it's totally sexual, the book, but at the same time, it's like a self-help book.
Yeah, well, I guess maybe we'll kind of close with this question. So yeah, I tried between the lines to give everyone the information they needed to take their own sort of journey. And everyone's journey is different, but the information, the pieces they needed to recognize these parts of themselves and recognize how their upbringing plays a part in their behavior and their relationship choices. So maybe I'll ask you, because I think obviously your questions so much come from your own perspective and your own experiences, which you've written about and discussed a bit. Did you get anything about that? Did you see anything about yourself in the pages or anything you related to?
Oh, yeah, totally. I mean, I think probably... I mean, I'm probably maybe not as exploratory as you, because I think I'd probably be like too neurotic. And but definitely, you know, relationships are an ongoing struggle to sort of manage and accept. And that's what I got out of it is this overwhelming feeling like, look, no matter what happens, I can't change the person I'm with, but I can try to always endeavor to change myself to be a better person.
And that's right, because you did write a post a while back about the non-monogamous experiments, didn't you?
I don't know. I can't remember.
but maybe not. I think you did. But anyway, about something along those lines. But oh, and so you said relationships were always a struggle. Do you know the why about yourself for that?
Probably not. No, probably I have to explore that more.
Yeah, maybe that's our next discussion.
Yes, definitely. Well, Neil, thanks so much. The truth, I highly recommend it. I've already read it twice now. Not just to prepare for this podcast, because I didn't even know we were going to do a podcast, but it was such an enjoyable book. I really loved it. And I hope everybody listening to this will read it, because it's very valuable. And look, let's podcast again about stuff other than books at some point.
Let's do it. I think we got a lot to discuss and a lot in common. Thank you.
Yeah. Thanks, Neil. Talk to you soon. Yeah. Bye.
Bye-bye.
For more from James, check out the James Altucher Show on the Stansberry Radio Network at stansberryradio.com and get yourself on the free insiders list today.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.